This is Higher Ed Heroes with Dr. Sebastian Kempf and Dr. Alistair Stark.
Welcome to a new episode of Higher Ed Heroes. My name is Seb, and as always, I'm joined here by my wonderful colleague, Al.
Hello, everyone. Our podcast is about transformative moments in the classroom. We believe that these moments when we bring classrooms to life can often be achieved by making small changes that are easy to adopt.
And that's our focus, small things communicated in simple ways by teachers who know that these practices make a difference to their students. And so our hope is that you as a listener might be able to reflect and even feel inspired to think about whether these might work for your own students.
And because we know our listeners are busy and time poor, we always want to communicate these small lessons in a jargon-free way, which is why we have the Teaching Jargon Buzzer, which we hit when we hear those buzzwords that might be more at home in a teaching committee or a faculty meeting. We haven't used a buzzer as much as I would like, Seb, so I'm going to be harsh today. Shall we introduce this week's guest?
Yes, now that you've scared our guest off, I have to do this even more politely than I normally do. I'm extremely pleased to welcome Paul Treshman as our guest today. Paul teaches in the School of Human Movement and Nutrition Sciences here at UQ. Paul, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much, Seb. Good to be here.
And I will be not as harsh as I may do.
Yeah, nice recovery there.
Thank you. One of the first questions that we want to get off with is about applied examples. One of the mottos you use in your classroom is apply first, explain later. In other words, you let your students first experience something through an applied example, and then you explain things to them afterwards. What's the logic or the idea behind that?
Really what we're trying to do, I guess if I want to give the analogy, it's like doing a jigsaw puzzle. So I always think if you've been given a 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle, you've got all the pieces, individual pieces scattered over your desktop there, ready to go. And at the moment, they're individual pieces of information, but at the moment, you're not sure how they connect together, how they work and what they're actually even trying to create. But what helps that process is the picture which is on the front cover there of your cardboard box. And as soon as you look at that, then you've got an understanding of where you're going, what success actually looks like. And so then what we can do is we're using those currently individual pieces that don't make too much sense, but we're looking at a frame of reference. We've got something as to where we can see it's applied. Then we can make sense of those individual pieces, connect them together to move forward in a logical manner. And so typically, I guess, when we're teaching is that we often teach individual bits of information that are abstract, whereas what we want really to do is to be able to give that applied example at the start so students know where they're going. The interesting thing that I see is that the teacher in this position actually does know what it looks like. They've got the applied example already in their head. So they're very familiar, but the students don't. So it's almost like the teacher's holding up the picture towards them, but the students don't have that idea. So really the logic here is how we can make sure students know where they're going so it's meaningful to them along the way, and that way they've got an understanding. So we've got then, once you've got the applied example, you can connect all those little bits back to that example. So we've constantly got a hook to hang this learning on.
That's a great analogy. I like the jigsaw puzzle. It does feel very relevant to teaching, trying to show the big picture with all the pieces.
And I'd love to know an example, perhaps, of what such a jigsaw puzzle analogy might look like in your classroom. Maybe talk us through an exercise that your students do under that motto, apply first, explain later.
One of the courses that I teach into is an undergraduate course for primary educators. So they are coming in with generalist knowledge here in the classroom, but I'm teaching in the HPE space and the movement space. So again, I'm aware of my audience going, some of these people are not interested in this work. But what I am aware of is they are interested in how to integrate learning between different subject areas. So often when we teach, we've got math, science, English, geography, all as separate siloed information, whereas we're trying to show how they can kind of connect together. So that's the topic ultimately in that second week. Again, I'm wanting to apply it first. So I get the students, they come straight into the lecture theatre and they've got the screen up there and that's all they know. And then I ask them very quickly to get into small groups. So they're now in groups of fours and fives. They get to select that, which is quite important. Then I have the next slide, which comes up, which says photo treasure hunt. So I'm trying to almost pique their interest a little bit. With the photo treasure hunt, what I do is I have a separate piece of paper for each of these groups. And on that piece of paper are 9 individual photos of different locations around the campus. But importantly, each of these groups have a different set of photos. There's some overlap, but basically they can't copy each other. With those particular photos, there's a range. Some are easy. Some are examples of outside a building with a building name, number, but others are less obvious. So we might have an unusual looking chair or a mural or something that's a little bit harder that you couldn't just find through your general walking, or it might even be a distinct tree in a area. So we're trying to make some of that hard with some subtle little clues along the way. And that's important there because they need to use broader skills. So underneath each of these photos then, we've got a point system. That point system is part of the activity here. So the lower the point, so it might be 1 or 2 points underneath a particular photo, is indicating that it's close to the lecture theatre that we're at. And then the higher point scoring of 10 to 12 is further away. So we're giving them some form of reference, but that's part of the activity as well. So then what the aim is really is for students to score as many points as possible in the 45 minutes by visiting these photo locations around the campus. And they need to take a photo of all group members at each photo location. So they need to all be in there. And then they return, the team with the most number of points in the allocated time wins. Importantly, each of these points are distributed evenly, so everyone can kind of achieve the same point. So then each of these groups are given a map of UQ, or map of the university, with a scale on it. And what their job is then to work together as a group to try and work out, okay, do we know where these locations are? And on those maps, on the map, just start to circle the areas where they think some of these are and plan a potential route that they might take. But also starting to think, well, we're trying to score a high number of points. Do we want to go further away to start? Do we want to start close? Do we want to follow a particular linear path to try and get there? So some sort of decision making going on there. And then they've just simply got a recording sheet. It's very basic, just a 6x10 grid, all the places and locations up the top. So they could list just the first one, so they've got a bit of an idea. They then move into the second step, which is I ask them to predict the distance that they think it is between the current location and the first place that they're going to go. So let's say they're at the lecture theatre and they're going to go to the refect, which is one of their photos. They might predict it's going to be 120 metres, something like that. But then I'm trying to integrate some numeracy in here. So we actually, and some digital work, so we actually get them to download the University Maps app. And so they locate those actual distances and then they write in underneath their predicted one what the actual distance proposed is. Then they move into the third step. So this is all still in the classroom at this point. They then need to predict the number of steps that they think that would take to travel between this particular location. Then they download a pedometer app, or many of them already have this on their step counters with their watch. And then they need to, during that process, actually record the number of steps that it would take to do that. Through that process, then you've already got a couple people, so we're averaging out scores. So there's a bit of numeracy work going on. And then they need to repeat that process. So by the end, we've actually, all students should have a predicted distance, an actual distance, predicted steps, and actual steps for all locations. But obviously that plan may change as they go along. And the very last bit is we just remind them about the required evidence before they go. So we talk about, well, you need to get a photo of all group members at the location. So you can't just have some people who race off. You all need to be there. So you need to think about how you're going to do this effectively. But the one that we throw in, it's a bit of a silly one, but it's got a purpose, is we say there's one bonus point at each location for every 2 non-class members you can get in your photo. So 2 random strangers from around the university. So suddenly you can see their eyes lighting up. Okay, that changes the strategy a little bit here. We could almost stay at 1 and try and get lots, or we could. So they're just thinking through some of these processes. And then I give them 10 minutes preparation time. So they've got prep time. They need to discuss the best order and route to take, but remembering that the score criteria is actually about scoring maximum number of points in designated time, and all students need to be successful, so they need to be there. So it's an inclusive approach. And they fill in the required information for the first location, and then after those 10 minutes, they go off, and I wait patiently there for the 45 minutes and for them to return.
Off they go, 45 minutes. You are enjoying yourself back in the lecture theatre. Now they come back. What's happening then?
Even interesting too, because we've got a group of students who might not be particularly interested in physical activity, but we've embedded this work in there. So you've got these university students who are actually running, which I find interesting too, because there is no prize, there's no glory that goes with it, but there's a sense of interest in it. So they come back. And I guess one of the first things that we're doing, coming back to the original point I made about the applied first, so they've actually done it. But now what they're trying to do is I'm trying to get them to understand, where is this related to areas in the curriculum? How are they actually going to be able to integrate this work, and how does this particular exercise represent that? One of the first things I ask them is, where might we use the data that we've just collected? What could we do with this if you, in your class here, were actually trying to teach some particular skills? They're starting to think through, yes, we've got some prediction, we've got some actual, we've got some data that could compare between our own work and others' group. And we're saying, how might you demonstrate that? Well, through graphing, for example. Now we've got some methods and processes and findings and maybe even writing that up. There could be some reflective work they do, geography work in here as well. There's digital technologies where they're using software. They're getting an understanding as to where they might go with this particular task. But then the next step, which is the real linking it back to the content, then so I'm doing it now, is they pull out the different curriculum documents from all their different areas, including HPE, but it's one of the ones that we're using. And we ask them in their groups to go through, where do you see these points linking through? And they go through it. And what's interesting is they're quite surprised how many areas are actually covered. But I think a bigger surprise is they notice how much overlap there is in these curriculum documents. Whereas if we only did that in its isolation, if we had have done a traditional manner and gone through each curriculum document and introduced those individual pieces, they wouldn't have seen those connections. Now they've got all those individual connections or those individual puzzle pieces, and they can link it back to the example that we just gave. And it makes sense. So every single student all the way through has been coming on this journey rather than I'm losing some along the way.
I know, and now I've been enlightened. I wondered where we were leading there. It's a lesson about the complexity and integration of the experience they're about to have and the curriculums themselves.
Absolutely, and it's really showing where these things apply in real life. So, for example, one of the most interesting ones that they come back and want to share, other than their photos with each other, which is always interesting, is how many people, random people, they got in their photo. That seems to be this point of interest. And it's not just because of the fact of having other people in. It's the communication process they had to go through to be able to get some of these people in their photos. And I ask them, and some have very positive experiences and we're able to do that effectively. Others didn't. And we talk about those communication processes, but we're applying it. So we're showing where this works. And so when they're looking at these content descriptions, which is the technical term, in the curriculum documents, these are these little elements they have to teach. They know what it feels like and they know what it looks like. But being able to communicate with someone, random person, asking them to be in a photo, do it succinctly, carefully, and non-threateningly, is a skill. And so we're trying to embed a lot of that learning in the experience.
You must find this, that the students hold a memory of the lesson a lot longer because they can go, oh, that lesson's attached to me having to find people to photograph in a non-threatening way, and I had to run around campus, and that resonates for longer than, okay, let's go through text X, Y, Z.
Absolutely. And again, it is about embedding in memory. And when you're experiencing it, you're obviously using various different senses in it, and it does hold longer. But even from a movement point of view, many of them are tired. And even when they looked at their numbers, then their predicted numbers got worse as they went along. And they start going, well, why is that? Well, fatigue is setting in here, or we had different people at different levels here. So we can start raising many different integrated issues as opposed to trying to deal with them separately.
I think that apply first, explain later is also, that's underneath all of this, is make students experience an applied task, and that hooks them and allows you to place the broader conceptual theoretical elements in a much more effective way that must clearly play into that.
It's much more tangible. Even to your point, it forces the teacher or the educator in this case to think, how does this actually apply in a real life context, and how can I make it meaningful to my audience? Again, it might be meaningful to the teacher, but if it's not meaningful to the audience, it probably won't have as much value. But I always come back to that typical one where you hear students complain, and it's often, unfortunately, in maths, where they'll say something like, when am I ever going to use this, or where on earth is this applied? And I think it forces the teacher to go, where is it applied, and where is it valuable for my audience in its application? And by doing that, then, yes, it is hopefully a bit more tangible for the students.
How much effort do you go into terms of setting this up? You take the photos. Obviously, the first time you do it, it's a huge amount of effort. Next time, it'll be slightly less. But you're going around campus, identifying places. You said you have these subtle places that they can't just get to. It takes a bit of work, I guess, in the first instance.
No, I've got three children and they just have to do all that work for me. No, it's a great point. And I think with any of these things, as soon as you hear this type of concept, if I heard this, I'd be going, that's too much work. Mm. And initially it is a bit of work, but again, once it's set up, it can then just roll around each time. There are always activities that are high prep and there are activities that are low prep. And this one is a high prep one, and I don't shy away from that because I do it early because I really want them to experience. And more importantly, I want them to see how they might set something up for their students and the joy that it brought them, and hopefully then the joy it'll bring the students. But there are so many other ways that we can just do this in a very, very low prep way that I think is far more tangible for anyone listening, I guess, to be able to use.
That exercise they do coming back into the classroom is not where it ends. Rather, you extend or you build on this further through the assessment you give them to do.
The downside of this particular approach is people can see one example and they kind of think that's where it is. And often people will go and copy that type of example if they're going to use it. And I'm not interested in people copying. I'm interested in them understanding the concept so they can apply it or transfer that learning. So one of the things we do in the lead up is after we've gone through what it looks like and what it might look like, we then say, how could you take this same concept and the same areas from the curriculum and apply it in a different example? And they work together on some ideas there. So we've shown them an example, or I have done something, then we, so they do something collectively as a group, and then the you is important, that the student, individual student, has to go off and apply it. And so coming back to your point, Seb, is they do have to put it into assessment task where they've done it with me, they've done a different one with some students and some peers to bounce ideas off, and then they've had to apply it again to a different context on their own. And so that's the important part. And I tell them what I'm really interested in is, this is not about your grade. I'm just not interested there. I'm interested in, how could you actually design something that would be wonderful for you to use with your students in your classes coming up? And I think that an incentive is much better. And I hear some wonderful reports back where they do use them when they get out and they start their teaching.
The high prep, low prep is a good way to describe it. I think the high prep instance has a lot of, you know, high quality outcomes and outputs, and it's something that you could refer back to constantly and use again and again throughout the semester.
And that's the point too, Ali, is that it might actually be the stimulus for the first lesson, but it actually could set up weeks within a unit. So exactly, it might be high prep for that one time, but when you're spacing it out, yeah.
I'd like to ask you to zoom out a little bit, Paul. Put simply, what's the benefit of making students learn in this way?
It actually shows students where they're going. They have an understanding of what success looks like in this particular context and where all the information is applied. So we're not leaving anyone behind from the start. They're coming along for that particular experience. But also, it's making the learning meaningful and relevant to the learner. So again, that's why it's important that we target it to our audience so they see where it applies in their current lives, not in their future lives, in their current lives or potentially future lives as well. I think one of the big ones is it does actually reduce the cognitive load. Suddenly, we're already attaching learning, so new learning, which is always hard, we're attaching it to something familiar. So they already have an understanding in their mental models of how they've shaped their world and what their experiences look like. They can already attach this new learning to this current or their previous experiences. And so as a result, it's easier for them to understand and connect as they go.
In terms of transferability, you could see this being used across disciplines. I know we've had in the past scavenger hunts from social scientists. This one's slightly different and it's got a lot more moving parts to it. So there's definitely transferability. But you could see different disciplines getting to the conceptual essence of what you're doing, couldn't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think maybe for looking at the low prep, because that's probably what people are interested in. What does this really look like in a simple context? And I guess I have a couple of key principles that I try to convey. And one is that, first of all, start off is, where is your actual content applied? And then where is it relevant to your audience? That's almost the first step I take. I go from there and try and think through, where are their stories? Where are their analogies? Where are their experiences or examples? So mine was an experience where you actually went and did, but you don't need to. You could simply be giving a story that might be personal, it might be of other people, but it relates to all the content in its applied form to the audience. And suddenly the group understand it. From there then, you can introduce those individual concepts or the content and keep linking it back to the story, and they understand where it fits together.
As an attentive listener, you probably heard it in Paul's voice. You can't see it, but it's just amazing. Once you get going, there's this thrill and enthusiasm and the passion behind this. And that's just wonderful to see. And it's so rich, you know, from the idea of lowering the cognitive load, apply first, explain later, rich examples, the photo treasure hunt, these comparative pictures. Wonderful. I could continue having this conversation, but I'm also mindful of the time specificities we self-impose on ourselves with our podcast. So I would like to use this as an opportunity to say a big thank you to you, Paul, in the hope that we can continue this conversation. And also to our listeners, if there was anything that has inspired you, please feel free to reach out to Paul, to Al, and to me. And you can find us, obviously, through our various social media channels.
Thanks for joining us on Higher Ed Heroes, and we look forward to your company again.